I said. "What did you see in those infusions?" This was a highly sensitive question to ask a blood drinker, and especially to ask this blood drinker who was the loyal biological descendant of Maharet. But even fledglings see images when they receive the blood of their makers. Even they experience a telepathic connection in those moments that is otherwise closed. I stood firm. Her face softened. She was sad, thoughtful. "Many things," she said, "as always. But this time they were images of the mountain and the valley where the twins had been born. At least I think that's what I was seeing, seeing them in their old village and seeing them when they were alive." "So this is what was on her mind," I said. "Memories of her human past." "I think so," said Jessie in a small voice. "There were other images, colliding, cascading, you know how it is, but again and again it was those long-ago times, sunshine, sunshine in the valley." David was giving me one of his subtle little gestures to be gentle, tread lightly. But we both knew these visions or memories were like unto what mortals think about at the end of their lives, their earliest, happiest memories. "She's in the Amazon, isn't she?" I said. "Deep in the jungles." "Yes," said Jessie. "She forbade me to tell anyone, and I'm breaking her confidence now. She's in uncharted jungle. The only tribe in the area fled after our arrival there." "I'm going there," I said. "I want to see for myself what's happening. If we're all to perish because of this voice, well, I want to hear from her what's going on."
"Lestat, she doesn't know what's going on," said Jessie. "That's what I'm trying to tell you."
"I know. I think all this disgusts her. She wants to be left alone. I think this voice may be driving her to think about destroying herself and Nakari and, well, all of us."
"I don't think the voice wants us destroyed," I said.
"But she may be thinking of it," said Jessie sharply. "I'm only speculating," she confessed. "I know she's confused, angry, even bitter. And this from Maharet. Maharet of all immortals. Maharet."
"She's human still," David said softly. He stroked Jessie's arm. He kissed her hair. "We're all human no matter how long we go on."
He spoke with the easy authority of an old Talamasca scholar, but I actually agreed with him.
"If you ask me," he said softly to Jessie, "finding her sister, being reunited with her sister, has destroyed Maharet."
Jessie wasn't surprised by this or jarred by it. "She never leaves Makari alone now," Jessie said. "And Cayman, well, Cayman is hopeless, roaming off for weeks at a time and stumbling back in with no memory of where he's been."
"Well, surely he's not the source of the voice," said David.
"No, of course not," I said. "But the voice is controlling him. Isn't that obvious? The voice is manipulating him as it has been all along. I suspect the voice began these massacres with him and then moved to enlisting others. The voice is working on a number of fronts, you might say. But Maharet and Cayman are too close for any telepathic bridge. She can't know, and he obviously can't tell her. He hasn't the wits to tell her or anyone." A dark, cold feeling came over me that, no matter how this came to an end, Cayman as an immortal on this earth was finished. Cayman wouldn't survive. And I dreaded the loss of Cayman. I dreaded the loss of all he'd experienced in his thousands of years of roaming, the loss of the tales he might have told of the early battles of the First Brood, of his later wanderings as Benjamin the Devil. I dreaded the loss of the gentle, sweet-hearted Cayman, whom I'd briefly known. This was too painful. Who else wouldn't survive? Jessie appeared to be reading my thoughts. She nodded. "I'm afraid you're right."
"Well, I think I know what's happening," I said. "I'm going there now. After I see her, I'll meet you in Manaus. That's far enough away from her, isn't it?"
David nodded. He said he knew of a fashionable little jungle lodge about 30 miles out of Manaus, located on the Akajatuba River.
Ah, British gentlemen. They always know how to go forth into the wilderness in style. I smiled. We agreed we'd meet there.
"Are you ready for this journey tonight?" he asked.
"Absolutely. It's westward. We'll gain 6 hours of darkness. Let's go."
"You do realize there's danger here, don't you?"
asked David. "You're going against Mahari's express wish."
"Of course," I said. "But why did you two come to me? Didn't you expect me to do something? Why are you both staring at me?"
"We came to urge you to go with us to New York," Jesse explained timidly. "To urge you to call a meeting of all the powerful ones of the tribe."
"You don't need me to do that," I said.
"Go yourselves, call the meeting."
"But everyone will come if you call the meeting," David said.
"And who is everyone?"
"I want to see Maharet."
They were edgy, uncertain.
"Look, you go on ahead of me to the Amazon now, and I'll meet you later this very night. And if I don't meet you in 2 nights at the jungle lodge on the river, well, have a requiem mass said for me in Notre Dame de Paris."
I left them then, knowing I'd be traveling much faster and higher than either of them, and also I went back to my chateau for my axe. It was rather silly, my wanting my little axe. I also stripped off the fancy velvet and lace, and put on a decent heavy leather jacket for the journey. I should have cut my hair for those jungles, but I was too damned vain to do that. Samson never loved his hair as much as I love mine. And then I set out for the Amazon. 5 hours before dawn in that great southerly region, I was descending towards the endless channel of deep darkness that was the Amazon rainforest, with a silver streak of river winding through it. I was scanning for pinpoints of light, infinitesimal flickers that no mortal eye could ever see. And then, taking my best shot at it, I went down, crashing through the wet, humid canopy, descending through crackling and breaking branches and vines until I landed rather awkwardly in the dense darkness of a grove of ancient trees. At once I was imprisoned by vines and clattering branches in the understory, but I stood quiet, very quiet, listening, making like a stealthy beast on the silent prowl. The air was wet and fragrant and filled with the simmering voices of the slithering, twittering, and voracious creatures around me everywhere. But I could hear their voices, too, Maharet and Cayman quarrelling in the ancient tongue. If there was a path in the vicinity leading towards those voices, well, I never found it. I didn't dare try to cut my way through with the axe. That would have made too much noise and dulled the blade. I just made my way slowly, painstakingly, over bulbous roots and through stinging brush, suppressing my respiration, my pulse, as best I could, along with my thoughts. I could hear Maharet's low, sobbing voice, and hear Cayman weeping. "Did you do these things?" she was demanding. She was speaking their ancient language. I caught the images. Was he the one who'd burnt the house in Bolivia? Had he done this? What about the carnage in Peru? Was he responsible for the other burnings? Was this his work, all of it? The time had come for him to tell her. The time had come for him to be honorable with her. I caught flashes from his mind, opened up like a ripe fruit in distress. Flames, anguished faces, people screaming. He was in a paroxysm of guilt. And there came into my mind the badly concealed image of a boiling and smoking volcano, an errant, shimmering flash. No! He was pleading with her to understand that he didn't know what he'd done. "I never killed Eric," he said. "I couldn't have been the one. I can't remember. He was dead, finished when I found his body." She didn't believe him. "Kill me!" he wailed suddenly. I drew closer and closer. "You did kill Eric, didn't you? You're the one who did it." Eric. Eric had been with Maharet over 20 years ago when Akasha rose. Eric had been at the council table with us when we'd confronted Akasha and opposed her. I had never known Eric and had never heard of Eric since. Male, I knew, had perished in New York, though precisely how I wasn't certain. He'd gone into the sun on the steps of St. Patrick's Cathedral, but surely that had not been enough to destroy him. But Eric, I didn't know. "It's finished," Cayman cried. "I will not continue. You do what you have to do with me. You do it!"
He was wailing like one in mourning.
"My journey in this world is finished."
I saw the volcano again. Pacaya. That was the name of the volcano. The image was coming from her, not from him. He couldn't even know what she was thinking. I continued moving through the jungles as slowly and silently as I could, but they were so deep into this agonizing discussion they took no notice. At last I came to the black steel mesh of a great enclosure. Dimly through the dense green foliage I could see both of them now in a cavernous, lighted room, Maharet with her arms around Cayman, Cayman with his face in his hands. Maharet was crying with a deep, wrenching feminine sound to it, like a young girl crying. She stood back and wiped her eyes with the back of her hand like a child might do it. Then she looked up. She'd seen me. "Leave here, Lestat," she said in a clear voice that carried over the vast enclosure. "Go. It's not safe for you here."
"I wouldn't harm him," Cayman said with a groan. "I would never harm him or anyone of my own will."
He was peering through the foliage, trying to make me out. I think he was actually addressing me. "Maharet, I must speak to you," I said. "I don't want to leave here without talking to you." Silence. "You know how things are, Maharet. I have to speak to you for myself and for others. Please, let me in."
"I don't want any of you here," she cried out. "Do you understand? Why do you challenge me?"
Suddenly, an invisible force ripped through the enclosure, uprooting palms, shearing off leaves, and then buckling the steel mesh before it. It drove me backwards, bits and pieces of the mesh flying everywhere in silver needles. It was the mind gift. I fought it with all my strength, but was powerless against it. It hurled me hundreds of yards, slamming me into one crackling tangle of foliage after another, until finally I fell against the broad red trunk of an immense tree. I was sprawled on its monstrous roots. I must have been a mile from where I'd been standing. I couldn't even see the light of the enclosure from here. I could hear nothing. I tried to stand up, but the understory here was too thick for anything but crawling or climbing towards a break in the jungle that surrounded a dim, winding pond. A great, scummy growth covered much of the surface, but here and there the water reflected the light of the sky like brilliant, silvery glass. It seemed to me that human hands, or immortal hands, had been at work here, arranging a rim of damp and pitted stones along the banks. And the insects were twittering and whistling in my ears, yet staying clear of me. I had a gash in my face, but it was, of course, already healing. They were dive-bombing at the blood and then veering off in natural revulsion. I sat down on the largest boulder and tried to think what to do. She wasn't going to permit me to come in, no doubt of that. But what had I just seen? What did it mean? I closed my eyes and listened, but all I heard were the voices of this rapacious and devouring jungle. There came a soft, living pressure on my back. I went alert instantly. There was a hand on my shoulder. A cloud of the sweetest perfume enveloped me, something of green herbs, flowers, and citrus, very strong. A vague sense of happiness came over me, but this was not originating with me. I knew it was absolutely pointless to struggle against this hand. Slowly I turned and looked down at the long white fingers, and then up into Makare's face. The pale blue eyes were innocent and wondering, the flesh like alabaster, all but glowing in the dark. No expression, actually, but a suggestion of drowsiness, of languor, and of sweetness. No harm. Just the faintest telepathic shimmer. My image in one of those rock videos I'd made years ago, dancing and singing about us. Gone. I searched for a spark of intellect, but this was like the agreeable face of some poor mad mortal in whom most of the brain had long ago been destroyed. It seemed the innocence and curiosity were artifacts of flesh and reflex more than anything else. Her mouth was the perfect pink of a seashell. She wore a long pink gown trimmed in gold. Here and there twinkled diamonds and amethysts, sewn exquisitely into the border.
"Beautiful," I whispered.
such loving work. I was as near to panic as I'd been in a long time. But then, as always happens, always when I'm afraid, when anything is making me afraid, I got angry. I remained very still. She appeared to be studying me in an almost dreamy way. But she wasn't. She might have been blind, for all I could tell. "Is it you?" I said. I struggled to say it in the ancient tongue, searching in memory for the smattering of it I knew. "Mekare, is it you?" There must have been a swelling of great pride in me, ridiculous arrogance to think suddenly with fierce elation that I could reach this creature when all others had failed, that I could touch the surface of her mind and quicken it. Desperately, I wanted to see that image of me again from the rock videos, that image or any image, but there was nothing. I sent forth the image. I remembered those songs and canticles of our origins, hoping against hope that this had some meaning for her. But one wrong word, and think what she might do. She could crush my skull with both hands. She could blast me with obliterating fire. But I couldn't think of this, or imagine it. "Beautiful," I said again. No change. I detected a low humming coming from her. We don't need our tongues to hum. It was almost a purr as might come from a cat, and suddenly her eyes were as remote and without consciousness as those of a statue. "Why are you doing it?" I asked. "Why kill all those young ones, those poor little young ones?" With no spark of recognition or response, she moved forward and kissed me. Kissing the right side of my face with those seashell pink lips, those cold lips. I brought my hand up slowly and let my fingers move into the soft thickness of her waving red hair. I touched her head ever so gently. "Mekare, trust in me," I whispered in that old language. A riot of sounds exploded behind me, again some force tearing through a forest that was almost impenetrable. The air was filled with a rain of tiny falling green leaves. I saw them falling on the viscid surface of the water. Maharit stood there to my left, helping Mekare to her feet, making soft, gentle crooning sounds as she did it, her fingers stroking Makari's face. I climbed to my feet as well. "You leave here now, Lestat," said Maharit, "and don't you come back, and don't you urge anyone ever again to come here." Her pale face was streaked with blood. There was blood on her pale green silk robe, blood in her hair, all this from weeping, blood tears, blood red lips. Mekare stood beside her, gazing at me impassively, eyes drifting over the palm fronds, the mesh of branches that shut out the sky, as if she were listening to the birds or the insects and not to anything spoken here. "Very well," I said. "I came to help. I came to learn what I could." "Say no more. I know why you came," she said. "You must go. I understand. I would have done the same thing if I were you. But you must tell the others never to look for us again. Never. Do you think I would ever try to hurt you? You or any of the others? My sister would never do this. She would never harm anyone. Go now."
"What about Pagaya, the volcano?" I asked.
"You can't do this, Maharet. You can't go into the volcano, you and Mekare. You can't do this to us."
"I know," she said. It was almost a groan. A terrible deep groan of anguish. A deep groan came out of Mekare as well. A horrid groan. It was as if her only voice were in her chest. And she turned to her sister suddenly, lifting her hands but only a little, and letting them drop, as if she couldn't manage to really work them at all.
"Let me talk to you," I pleaded.
Kerman was coming towards us, and Mekare turned sharply away and moved towards him and lay against his chest, and he enfolded her with his arms. Maharet stared at me. She was shaking her head, moaning as if her fevered thoughts had a little song to them of moans.
Before I could speak again, there came a heated blast of air against my face and chest. It blinded me. I thought it was the fire gift, and she was making an immediate mockery of her own words. "Well, brat prince," I thought, "you gambled, you lost, and you get to die now. Here's your personal pacaya." But I was merely flying backwards through the bracken again, smashing against tree trunks and through clattering, crackling branches and wet fronds. I twisted and turned with all my might, trying to escape this thing, trying to flee to one side or the other, but it was driving me backwards at such speed that I was helpless. Finally, I was flung down in a grassy place, an open grassy circle of sorts, unable for a moment to move, my body aching all over. My hands and face were badly cut. My eyes were stinging. I was covered with dirt and broken leaves. I climbed to my knees, and then to my feet. The sky above was a deep, radiant blue, with the jungles rising high all around as if to engulf it. I could see the remains of some huts here, that this had been a village once, but it was now in ruins. It took me a moment to catch my breath and then to wipe my face with my handkerchief and wipe the blood from the cuts on my hands. My head throbbed. It was half an hour before I reached the lodge on the banks of the river. I found David and Jesse in a tasteful tropical suite there, all very civilized and pretty, with white curtains and veils of bleached mosquito netting over the white iron bed. Candles burned all through the rooms and the manicured gardens and around a small swimming pool. Such luxury on the edge of chaos. I stripped everything off and bathed in the fresh, clean swimming pool. David stood by with a heap of white towels. When I was myself again, as best as I could be, with these soiled and torn clothes, I went into the cozy little parlour with him. I related what I'd seen. "Cayman's in the grip of the voice, that's clear," I said. "Whether Maharitz heard it or not, I have no idea. But Macari gave me no hint of menace, no hint of mind or cunning or what?" Jesse asked. "No hint that the voice was coming from her," I said. "How could it possibly be coming from her?" "You're joking, surely," I said. "No, I'm not," said Jesse. In a low, confidential tone, I told them all I knew of the voice. I told them how it had been speaking to me for years, how it talked of beauty and love, and how it had nudged me once to burn and destroy the Mavericks in Paris. I told them all about the voice, its games with my reflection in the mirror. "So you're saying it's some demonic ancient one," said Jesse, "trying to take possession of blood drinkers, and that it's taken possession of Cayman, and Maharit knows it?" Her eyes were glassy with tears that were slowly thickening into pure blood. She brushed her curling copper hair back from her face. She looked unutterably sad. "Well, that's one way of putting it," I said. "You really have no clue who the voice is?" I lost all taste for this conversation. I had too much thinking to do, and I needed to do it quickly. I didn't tell them about the image of Pacaya in Guatemala. Why should I? What could they do about it? She had said she wouldn't harm us. I went out of the room, motioning for them to let me go, and I stood in this dreamy little tropical garden. I could hear a waterfall somewhere, perhaps more than one, and that throbbing engine of the jungle, that engine of so many voices. "Who are you, voice?" I asked aloud. "Why don't you tell me? I think it's time, don't you?" Laughter. Low laughter and that same distinctly male timbre, right inside my head. "What's the name of the game, voice?" I asked. "How many are going to have to die before you finish? And what is it you really want?" No answer. But I felt certain someone was watching me. Someone was off in the jungles, beyond the border of this garden, beyond this horseshoe of little thatched roof luxurious guest suites, staring at me. "Can you even guess what I suffer?" said the voice. "No," I said. "Tell me about it." Silence. It was gone. I could feel its distinct absence. I waited a long time, then I walked back into the little suite. They were sitting together now on the foot of the bed, which looked a bit like a shrine, with all its draped white mosquito netting. David was holding Jesse. Jesse was drooping like a broken flower. "Let's do as Maharit asks," I said. "Perhaps she has some plan she doesn't dare confide in anyone, and we owe it to her and to ourselves to allow her time to work it. I need a plan myself. This isn't the moment for me to act on my suspicions."
"But what are your suspicions?" demanded Jesse. "You can't think Makari has the cunning to do all this."
"No, not Makari. I suspect Makari is holding the voice back."
"But how could she do that?"
Jesse pressed. "She's only the host of the Corps." I didn't answer. I marveled that she hadn't guessed it. I wondered how many others really hadn't guessed it. Or was everyone out there, Benji and all those calling him, afraid to say the obvious?
"I want you to come with us to New York," said David. "I hope many others are already there."
"What if that is exactly what the voice wants?" I sighed. "What if it's becoming ever more clever at controlling others like Cayman and enlisting them in its pogroms? We all gather in New York, and the voice brings a cabal of monsters against us. Seems foolish to make it so easy for the voice."
But I didn't say this with much conviction.
"Then what is your plan?" asked David.
"I told you. I need time to think on it."
"But who is this voice?" Jesse pleaded.
"Darling," said David, in a low and reverent voice as he embraced her. "The voice is Amo, the spirit inside Makari, and he can hear all that we are saying to one another right now." A look of unspeakable horror swept over her face, and then a sudden collapse into deep quiet. She sat staring in front of her, eyes narrowing but then widening very slowly with her thoughts.
"But the spirit is unconscious," she whispered, pondering it, her soft golden eyebrows knitting. "For millennia it's been unconscious. The spirit said Amel is no more."
"And what is 6,000 years to a spirit?" I asked. "It's come to consciousness, and it's talking, and it's lonely, and it's vindictive, and it's confused, and damned incapable, it seems, of really getting whatever it wants. Maybe it doesn't even know what it wants." I could see David flinching, see his right hand rising just a little, and pleading with me to take the edge off, not to push it. I stood stock still, looking out into the night, waiting, waiting for the voice to speak. But the voice didn't speak.
"Go on to New York," I said. "As long as it can rouse and control others, no place is safe. Maybe Seth and Farid are headed there. Surely they know what's happening. Get on the radio with Benji and call to Seth. Figure some way to disguise your meaning. You're good at that. Call to any old ones who might help us. If there are old ones out there who can be roused to burn, there are others who can be roused to fight. And we do have some time, after all."
"Time? What makes you say that?" asked David.
"I just explained it," I said. "It hasn't figured out yet how to get what it wants. It may not even know yet how to articulate its own ambitions, plans, desires." I left them there. It was day now on the European continent, but I didn't want to stay in that wild, primitive and devouring place. It made me bloody furious that I couldn't get back home. I went north towards Florida, and made it to a fine Miami hotel before dawn. I rented a suite on a high floor with a balcony looking out over warm, sweet Biscayne Bay, and I sat out there, my foot on the ledge, loving the moist, tender breeze, and looking at the huge, ghostly clouds of the deep Miami sky and thinking about it. What if I was wrong? What if it wasn't Amel? But then I thought back to those first murmurings. Beauty. Love. It had been trying to tell me something momentous about itself, and I had dismissed it. I had had no patience with its ravings, its desperate efforts. "You don't know what I suffer." "I was wrong," I said now.
watching these huge tumbling clouds shift and drift past me. I should have paid more attention to what you were trying to say. I should have talked to you. I wish I had. Is it too late?
Silence.
You too have your story, I said. I was cruel not to realize it. I was cruel not to think of your capacity for suffering.
Silence.
I got up and paced the dark, thick carpet. Then I went back out on the balcony and looked at the lightening sky. Sunrise coming. Relentless, implacable sunrise. So comforting to the world of mortal beings and animal things, and the plants breaking through the soil everywhere, and the trees sighing through a billion leaves, and so deadly to us.
Voice, I am sorry, I said.
I saw Pacaya volcano again, that image that had flashed repeatedly through Maharet's mind, that fiery image. I saw in terror her carrying her sister upwards, like an angel with a child in its arms, until she was above that horrid, gaping mouth of fire. Suddenly I felt the presence of the other.
No, said the voice, it's not too late. We'll talk, you and I. When the time comes.
Then you do have a plan? I asked. You aren't just slaughtering all your own progeny?
Progeny?
He laughed. Imagine your every limb hung with chains, your fingers bound with weights, your feet connected by a thousand roots to others. Progeny be damned! The sun was indeed rising. It was rising for the voice, too, in that jungle, if he was in that jungle. I closed up the room, pulled the draperies shut, went into the spacious walk-in closet and lay down to sleep, furious that I wouldn't be able to head for home until the inevitable sunset. 2 nights later, it hit Paris. The voice hadn't spoken a word to me in the interim, and then it hit Paris. By the time I got there, it was over. A little hotel in the Rue Saint-Jacques was burnt to the ground, and the firefighters were dousing the blackened ruins with water, the smoke and steam rising between the narrow, intact buildings on either side of it. There were no voices here in the heart of Paris now. Those who had escaped had fled to the countryside, and they were still pleading with others to follow their example. I passed slowly, unnoticed, through the sidewalk spectators. Just a flashy young man in violet sunglasses and a worn leather coat with unruly long blonde hair, secretly carrying a deadly axe with him. But I was sure I'd heard one plea, stronger than many of the others, when the burning had started, when those first howls had drifted over the wind, a woman pleading in Italian for me to come. I was certain I'd heard a sobbing entreaty. I am Bianca Soldarini. Well, if I'd heard it, it was silent now. It was gone. I walked along, noting the stains of black grease on the pavements. In one doorway, unmarked as yet, lay a black, slimy hulk of burnt bones and shapeless globs of tissue. Could there have been life in that still? How old was that? Was that the beautiful, legendary Bianca Soldarini? My soul shriveled. I sauntered close to it. No one passing me noticed. I touched this mass of steaming blood and guts with my boot. It was melting, the bones losing their shape, the whole little heap melting on the stones. There could be nothing alive there. "You proud of yourself, voice?" I asked. But he wasn't there. Not there at all. I would have known if he was there. He hadn't spoken to me again since Miami. Not in spite of all my pleas, my questions, my long confessions of respect, interest, immense desire to understand.
Amel, talk to me,
I'd said over and over again. Had it found others to love? Others infinitely more malleable and useful? And more to the point, what was I going to do? What did I have to offer all those who seemed to think, for the most foolish reasons, that I could somehow solve all this? Meanwhile, coven houses and young ones had perished. And now this in Paris.
For hours I searched the Quartier Latin. I searched all of central Paris, walking the banks of the Seine and homing, as I always did, to Notre Dame. Nothing. Not a single preternatural voice left in Paris. All those paparazzi gone. It was almost like those olden nights when I thought I was the only vampire in the world, and I'd walked these streets alone, longing for the voices of others. And all the time, those other blood drinkers, those evil blood drinkers, led by Armand, had been hiding under the cemetery of Les Innocents. I saw bones in stacks, skulls, rotting bones. But this was no image of the old catacombs of those children of Satan in the 18th century. These were images of the catacombs under Paris today, where all the bones of the old cemetery had been moved long after the children of Satan had been dissolved into ruin. Catacombs. Images of bones. I heard a female blood drinker crying. Two creatures, and one speaking very rapidly in a low whisper. I knew that timbre. That was the voice I'd heard earlier this night. I left the Ile de la Cité and started for the catacombs. In a flash I caught a vision of two women together weeping, the elder a white skeletal monster with a hag's hair, horrid, like something painted by Goya. Then it was gone, and I couldn't home in on it again. "Bianca," I said. "Bianca!" I picked up speed. I knew where those tunnels were, those deep, dark, ugly tunnels beneath the city whose walls are packed with the disintegrating bones of centuries of dead Parisians. The public was admitted to those underground passages. I knew the public entrance. I was racing towards the Place d'Enfer Rochereau and had almost reached the spot when a strange sight stopped me. It was a brilliant flash at the entrance to the tunnel, as if a flame had erupted from the mouth of the charnel house. The dark, wooden-pedimented building that sheltered the entrance exploded and fell to pieces with a loud clatter. I saw a female blood drinker, with long blonde hair, white, immensely powerful, rising from the pavement, and in her arms two other figures, both clinging to her, one with a skeletal white arm and hag hair buried against her bosom, the other auburn-haired and shaking with sobs. For me, for my eyes, this mysterious being slowed her ascent, and we gazed for one split second at one another. "I will see you again, brave one." Then she was gone. I felt a blast of air against my face. I was sitting on the pavement when I came to my senses. Sévrin. That was the name imprinted on my mind. Sévrin. But who was this Sévrin? I was still sitting there staring at the entrance to the tunnel when I heard fast, crisp steps approaching, someone walking steadily, heavily and fast. "Get up, Lestat!" I turned and looked up into the face of my mother. There she was, after all these years, in her old khaki safari jacket and faded jeans, her hair in a braid over her shoulder, her pale face like a porcelain mask. "Come on, stand up!" she said, those cold blue eyes flashing in the lights of the burning building at the mouth of the tunnel. And in that moment, as love and resentment clashed with humbling fury, I was back at home, hundreds of years ago, walking with her in those cold, barren fields, with her haranguing me in that impatient voice, "Get up! Move! Come on!" "What are you going to do if I don't?" I snarled. "Slap me?" And that's what she did. She slapped me. "Get up quickly," she said. "Take me to that glorified shelter you've made for yourself in the old castle. We must talk. Tomorrow night I'll take you to Sévrin."
13. Marius. Reunion on the Brazilian shore. It seemed the voice woke him each evening, telling him to go out and cleanse the country around him of mavericks, that he would be infinitely more content if he did this. The voice took a gentle tack with him.
"I know you, Marius. I know you well. I know that you love your companion Daniel. Do as I ask of you, and he will never be in danger."
Marius ignored the voice, as certainly as a priest might ignore the small voice of Satan,
calculating all the while. How does this creature get into my brain? How does he manage to speak to me in such a palpable, warm way, as if we were brothers?
I am you, Marius, and you are me, said the voice. Listen to what I say.
Marius wouldn't let Daniel out of his sight. The handsome old coven house in Santa Teresa had been burned to the ground. If any of the young survived in Rio de Janeiro, they were silent. Even the great country surrounding the city was silent. No sharp, tinny and piercing cries out there any more for help. As they walked along the beach together near midnight, Daniel and Marius, side by side at the end of the waves, Marius listened. He was a beachcomber in khaki, with his sandals tied to his belt, and Daniel was easy in his polo shirt and dungarees, sneakers easily pushing against the hard sand. Far off in the jungles to the north, Marius heard preternatural voices, faint but filled with rage. Maharet was there now, he knew it, in those Amazonian jungles. He recognized some faint pattern of speech, of telepathic eruption that even the great Maharet could not contain or control. He and Daniel had to leave Brazil. This was a safe place no longer, Daniel said he understood. Whither thou goest, I go, he had said. It amazed Marius that Daniel seemed so indifferent to danger, that his zest for all he saw around him remained so strong. Having survived madness, he was now wise beyond his years in the blood, accepting that another crisis had come, and that he might survive this one as he had survived the Akashan massacre before. As he himself had put it earlier this evening, I was born to darkness in the midst of a storm. Marius loved Daniel. He had salvaged Daniel from the aftermath of that storm, and never for one moment regretted it. Marius knew that Daniel had also salvaged him from the same chaos, becoming for Marius someone Marius could care for, someone Marius could personally love. It meant the world to Marius that he was not walking on this beach alone, that Daniel was walking at his side. The night was magnificent, as it so often was over Copacabana Bay. The silvery surf raging on the endless sand, mortals few and far between and keeping to themselves. The great city of Rio was never silent, and the din of traffic and machines and the teeming mortal voices blended for Marius with the sweet and incessant symphony of the waves. All things under heaven contain some blessing, and so it is with modern noise that it can become the gentle roar of a waterfall in our ears, protecting us from disparate and ghastly sounds. Ah, but what is heaven but a silent and indifferent void through which the shattering noise of explosions echo forever or are heard not at all? And men once spoke of the music of the spheres. But we are blessed to be tiny beings in this universe. We are blessed to feel momentous because we are larger than these grains of sand. Something intruded suddenly on his thoughts. Far ahead in the darkness he spied a lone figure coming towards them. Immortal, powerful, child of the millennia. He drew Daniel close to him, putting his arm around Daniel as if Daniel were his son. Daniel, too, had sensed the presence, perhaps even heard the subtle heartbeat. Who are you? He could pick up no answer. The figure came on steadily, a slim, delicate-boned male in a soft ankle-length white Arabic robe, the robe flapping in the wind. His short white hair was mussed by the wind. The moonlight made an aureole out of it, and the steps came on, as the steps of the ancient always do, with measured strength indifferent to the softness of the terrain. Now is this how it is to happen? Had the voice roused this rude instrument to smite them with fire? There was nothing to do but move steadily towards this figure. What good would it do to flee? With one so old, flight might be impossible, for eyes such as these can follow an ascending body everywhere, when there is nothing else to distract them. Again Marius identified himself silently, but there was no response, not the smallest inkling of a thought, an attitude, an emotion from the other, as he slowly came into full view. They approached each other in silence, crunch of sand underfoot, sigh of the wind, and then the white-haired one extended his hand, long, almost spidery fingers.
"Marius," he said, "my beloved,
my saviour of long ago, my friend.
I know you? Asked Marius politely. Even as he clasped the hand, he divined nothing but what the agreeable and open face reflected, friendship. No danger. But this one was far older than Marius, perhaps as much as 1,000 years. His eyes were black, and his unblemished skin the colour of amber, which made his white hair all the more remarkable, a cloud of white light around his head.
"I'm Tescarmon," said the older one, "and you? You are the one who gave me new life."
"How did I ever do that?" asked Marius. "When and where did we ever meet?"
"Come, let's find a quiet place where we can talk."
"My rooms?" asked Marius.
"If you wish. Or the bench up there at the boardwalk. This is a quiet night on the boardwalk, and the sea is like molten silver to my eyes. The breeze is fragrant and comforting. Let's go there."
They climbed the sands together, Daniel hanging slightly behind as if it were the respectful thing to do. And when Marius and Tescarmon sat down together, Daniel chose another bench nearby. They were all three facing the distant waves, facing that writhing, pearly surf. Beyond the mist, the stars climbed forever. Great, far-off mountains and rocks were purely dark. Marius looked at Daniel anxiously. He didn't want to divide from Daniel of even a few feet.
"Don't be concerned for him now," said Tescarmon. "We are more than adequate to protect him. And what stalks the young blood-drinkers tonight is on the move in other cities. The young of this place have already been exterminated. It turned them against each other. It played on their distrust of one another and their escalating fear. It was not content merely with the burning of the house. It hunted them down, one by one."
"So that is how it is being done."
"That is one way. There are others. It becomes more clever with every passing night."
"I saw it," said Marius. And indeed he had in images, those battles, images he would like very much to forget. "But please, tell who you are and what you want with me." He had said this politely, but he was a little ashamed of himself. After all, obviously this old one was friendly and knowledgeable as to what was happening. This old one wanted to help.
"There must be a gathering," said Tescarmon, "and the place will be in New York."
He gave a little laugh.
"I think Benji Mahmoud has marked this spot there with his enterprising broadcasts. But then, two of the authors of the Vampire Chronicles are there already, and they are known to the entire world of the undead."
"I have nothing against any particular gathering place," said Marius, "and Benji is no stranger to me." Marius had made Benji a vampire, brought him and his companion Sibel over, and given them to his fledgling Armand, but he saw no reason to confide this to a stranger. A stranger who likely knew it anyway, especially one whose thoughts he couldn't hear. Not even the faintest shimmer came to him. But he caught, suddenly, a very strong emanation from Daniel.
"He is the one who made you."
Marius was visibly startled, glancing first at Daniel, who sat staring at him, sideways on the bench with one leg up and his arms casually wrapped around his knee. Daniel was plainly fascinated. Marius looked back to Tescarmon, this smaller blood-drinker who gazed at him with steady black eyes.
"The one who made me is dead," he said aloud, again glancing at Daniel and then back to Tescarmon. "He died the very night I was born to darkness. That was 2,000 years ago in a forest in northern Europe. Those events are engraved on my soul."
"And on mine," said Tescarmon.
"But I did not die that night, and I did make you what you are now. I was the blood god imprisoned in that oak to which the druids brought you. It was I that blackened and scarred and ruined thing that gave you the blood, and told you to escape the druids, not to remain imprisoned in the oak as a blood god, but to go down to Egypt, no matter what the cost, and see what had happened to the mother and the father. To find out why we had, so many of us, been horribly burned in our very shrines.
Prisons, you mean, not shrines, Marius whispered. He stared forward at the distant horizon where the dark, undulating sea met the silver sky. Could this be possible? The horrific sights and sounds of that night came back to him. The deep oaken forest, his own helplessness as, a prisoner of the Druids, he'd been dragged towards the shrine of the god within the tree. And then had come those staggering moments when the burnt and white-haired god had spoken to him and explained the powers of the blood he would share. "But I saw them throw your body on the pyre afterwards," said Marius. "I tried to save you, but I didn't know my own strength then in the blood. I saw you burned." He shook his head, peering earnestly into the being's eyes. "Why would one so old and so seemingly wise lie about these things?" "I am not lying to you," said Descarmen gently. "You saw them try to immolate me. But I was 1,000 years old then, Marius. Perhaps older. I didn't know my own strength either. But when you fled, as I'd instructed you to do, when all of them to a man ran after you through that forest, I escaped those burning logs." Marius stared at Descarmen, stared at the dark eyes looking at him, at the simple but kindly mouth. Out of the gloom of memory emerged that fragile, blackened figure clinging to dark, unnatural life through will. Suddenly Marius knew. He knew it now, knew it in countless subtle ways. He knew the being's demeanour, the dark and unwavering gaze. He knew the calm and almost melodious cadence of his speech, and even the contained and almost shrinking posture with which he sat there on the bench. And he knew why he could hear nothing from this one's mind. This was the Maker. The Maker had survived. The older one was smiling at him now as he sat composed with his hands folded in his lap. The soft white thobe, or cassock, hung softly about his dignified frame, and he seemed pleased, very pleased, that Marius knew the truth. He was as splendid an immortal now with his smooth, tawny skin and full white hair as any Marius had ever seen. Something quickened in Marius, something he had not felt in a very long time. There was some certainty of goodness, perhaps, that overcame him, some certainty of happiness, of the true possibility of life containing moments of exaltation and joy. He'd never really felt that certainty for very long at any one time, and he hadn't expected to feel it now. Yet he was overcome with the purest goodwill, suddenly, that such a thing could be possible, that this one, known to him in a fatal intimacy at the very beginning of his dark journey, could in fact be here with him now. In the past, only young ones and strangers had brought such comfort. Nothing good had ever united him with those first years, nothing to warm the heart. He wanted to speak, but he feared to cheapen his feeling in trying to express it. He sat quiet, wondering if his face expressed the gratitude he felt that this being had come to him here. "I suffered unbearably," said Descarmen. "But it was all that you'd revealed to me, Marius, that gave me the strength to crawl away from that pyre and reach for hope. You see, I had never known a being like you, Marius. In that awful northern forest, I had never known anything of your Roman world. I had known the old blood religion of Queen Akasha. I had been her faithful blood god. I knew the worship of the Druids echoing the ancient blood-drinker cults of Egypt, and that was all I knew. Not until that night when I took you in my arms to make you the new blood god, and your heart and soul poured into mine." The smile was gone, and Escarmon's face was reflective, his dark brows knitted, his eyes narrow, as he looked out at the foaming sea. He went on speaking. "For 1,000 years I'd served the Mother, believed in the old religion. Remain imprisoned until the worshippers bring the evildoers, look into their hearts for right and wrong and truth, and then execute them for the faithful of the forest and drink their precious blood. 1,000 years. And never had I dreamed of the life you lived, Marius.
I'd been born a village child, a farmer's boy, and oh, what an honour, they told me, that as a young man I had become beautiful enough to offer to the secret mother, the queen who reigns forever, and from whom a poor boy, an ignorant boy, could not conceivably escape. Marius didn't want to say a word. This was the voice that had lulled him into calm compliance all those centuries ago inside that oak tree. This was the voice that had confessed secrets to him which had given him hope that he might survive that night, to live in a new way. He only wanted for Tescarmen to go on. "And then I saw your life," said Tescarmen. "Your life, blazing in the images you yielded to me. I saw your glorious house in Rome, the magnificent temples before which you'd worshipped, with all those pure and lofty columns and brightly painted marble gods and goddesses so splendidly realized, and those colored rooms in which you'd lived and studied and dreamed and laughed and sang and loved. It wasn't the wealth, surely you understand me, not the gold, not the glittering mosaics. I saw your libraries. I saw and heard your quick-witted and curious companions. I saw the full-blooming power of your experience, the life of a cultured Roman, the life that had made you what you were. I saw the beauty of Italy. I saw the beauty of fleshly love. I saw the beauty of ideas. I saw the beauty of the sea." A shock passed through Marius, but he remained silent. Tescarmen paused, eyes still fixed on the distant surf. His eyes returned to Marius. He looked past him for a moment and smiled at Daniel, who was listening as if rapt.
"I had never fully understood till that moment," said Tescarmen, "that we are the sum of all we've seen and all we've appreciated and understood. You were the sum of sunshine on marble floors filled with pictures of divine beings who laughed and loved and drank the fruit of the vine as surely as you were the sum of the poets and historians and philosophers you'd read. You were the sum and the fount of what you'd cherished and chosen to abide and all you had loved."
He left off talking. Nothing had changed in the night. Behind them the sparse traffic of early morning moved on the Avenida Atlantica, and the voices of the city rose and subsided beneath the hushed voice of the sea. But Marius was changed. Changed forever. "Tell me what happened," Marius pressed. The intimacy of that long-ago blood exchange in the oak shimmered in his mind. "Where did you go? How did you survive?" Tescarmen nodded. He was still looking out to sea. "The woods were thick in those times. You remember them. Moderns have no conception of that old woodland, that savage wilderness of trees, ancient and young, spreading across Europe, against which each hamlet or village or town must fight for its life. Into that woodland I slithered like a lizard. I fed on the vermin of the forest. I fed on what could not escape me, even as I could not walk without pain, even as the sun found me again and again in dank hollows, and claimed even more of my skin because I could not dig deep to protect myself from it with these hands." He looked at his fingers. "In time," he said with a sigh, "I found a woman in a lowly hut, a cunning woman, a healer, such a thing as men call a witch and a hag. Hesketh was her name. She was a prisoner of hideousness, as was I. But I begged for her patience. She could not destroy me, and I fascinated her, and my suffering touched her heart. Oh, this was so remarkable to me. You cannot imagine. What did I know of compassion, of mercy, of love? She had pity on me, and curiosity burned within her. She would not have me suffer. And some bond was forged before language could express it even in the simplest form. Even in my weakened state, I worked small miracles for her effortlessly, told her when strangers were approaching, raked their minds for the questions they were coming to ask her, for the curses they wanted her to bring down on their enemies. I warned of anyone who sought to do her harm. An evil lad bent on murdering her, I easily overpowered and from him drank my fill before her unquestioning eyes. I read her thoughts,
and I found the poetry inside of her, beneath the misfortune of warts and pock-marked skin, of hunched shoulders and deformed limbs. I loved her. Indeed, she became whole and entire.